chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them,
but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing. We try to keep the show as relevant as possible, I say, in a month where we're talking about films that are 22 years old. But this week is a really special case. Not only are we talking about an absolute classic of the queer rom-com genre, we're talking about it during the week in which National Coming Out Day happens to fall. And honestly, I could not be happier about that, listeners. And joining me for this conversation is not my lovely co-host, Eliza, who is taking a well-deserved break from the podcast this week, but our dear and beloved friend and romantic lead, Melissa Englander. Hey, Melissa, Hello. Will you introduce yourself to the people?
Sure. So I'm Melissa, and I do have a full-time job and a master's, but neither of them are really relevant to why you asked me to be on. You asked me to be on because I love this movie dearly, and I'm a pretty gay. I think that's why.
Yeah, those are the check marks that I ticked when I was figuring out who to get to come on the show today. So yeah.
Although I mean, my master's in public policy, so that kind of matters for a rant I'll go on later, I'm sure.
Yeah, she knows a thing or two about politics, you guys. She knows a thing or two. All right, Melissa, what are we talking about this week?
This week we were talking about Jamie Babbitt's released in 2000, filmed in 99 classic, But I'm a Cheerleader.
Yes, we located in 99 because that is when it premiered on the festival circuit, right?
That's correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I want to get my dramaturgy right on this.
To my knowledge, you're right. So.
I believe that's true. If we're wrong, come for us in the comments and we'll fight you and it'll be great.
It'll be good.
All right. Much to cover today, so I don't want to delay any further. Everyone, here is your Google summary for But I'm a Cheerleader, the year of our Lord, 1999. Megan, played by Natasha Lyonne, considers herself a typical American girl. She excels in school and cheerleading, and she has a handsome football-playing boyfriend, even though she isn't that crazy about him. So she's stunned when her parents decide she's gay and send her to True Directions, a boot camp meant to alter her sexual orientation. While there, Megan meets a rebellious and unashamed teen lesbian, Graham, played by Clea DuVall. Though Megan still feels confused, she starts to have feelings for Graham. Well, Melissa, that is what Google says But I'm a Cheerleader is about. But what is But I'm a Cheerleader? Ooh, syntax. What is the film really about?
It's so hilarious to see you and hear you, I guess, in this mode. It's so great. I guess But I'm a Cheerleader is a movie about queer joy and the different ways that queerness can look, set in the context of the very real, but in this film, satirized conversion therapy and gender roles and, I don't know, RuPaul thrusting underneath the car. I don't know.
It doesn't get better than that. Like, that's the height of culture. I mean, it really does not.
Fracking icon, RuPaul Charles.
I think that what surprises me about this film still, and I think I first saw this when I was a teenager, is that it has no right to be a romance or a comedy or a lighthearted camp romp, given the subject matter that it portrays, which is conversion therapy. But it finds a way, like you said, to pierce through all of that and find joy and delight in mocking both kind of, you know, our old-fashioned understandings of sexuality, but also how that's tied to the gender binary.
Yeah, it's a really interesting film to watch once you even hear more about Jamie Babbitt, the director, talk about it. As part of research for this, I went back and listened to Diking Out podcast's interview with Jamie, which happened during the 20-year anniversary of the film when it was re-released. And Jamie Babbitt is a femme lesbian, and she didn't see herself represented. And she also grew up with her mother running a rehabilitation program. So it was just, it's this movie full of love for queer culture and representation for femme lesbianism. It's, I don't know where my point is going with this. I just really love this movie. And it's just very cool to have all the context of where it comes from and why it exists. And Jamie Babbitt, you know, making fun of queer people just as much as she's making fun of non-queer people.
Right. There's a lot of delight and I think showing off, like you said, in terms of representation, we have a large gamut, I would say, of the queer community. There's not trans representation per se, no. Although we'll talk about what's going on with some of the gender stuff in a minute.
Yeah.
But all of the sort of stereotypes, you know, we get your lipstick lesbian, we get your butch lesbian, we get your very femme gay musical theater boy, you know, we get your neurotic gay Jewish boy.
Oh boy.
And I appreciate all of those. It having fun with those tropes, like you said, it's all about delight. They're having fun with those tropes rather than feeling the burden of flipping them on their head.
It's interesting, and I didn't know this. I knew that the film wasn't commercially successful at first, but the interview I listened to today, Jamie Babbitt talked about how she got really negative reviews from older gay male critics because this movie came out in, 2000, so tail end of the AIDS crisis. Antiretroviral therapy really wasn't approved until, let me restate that, CDC really only released the national treatment guidelines for HIV in 1998. So it was the tail end of this plague, and this movie is full of just stereotypes of gay men. And it's, it's a very loving stereotype. It's, very rooted in that John Waters aesthetic, and the mom is a John Waters actress. But it was hard. The Entertainment Weekly original review was an F. Like, it was hated.
Wow.
Yeah, even as queer women were lining up around the block to see it.
So I guess that's an interesting question to think about. I mean, what do you think about that criticism coming from gay men for a film that I would argue very much has a queer women's lens?
It's sort of an interesting argument because I obviously am a queer woman and I love this film very much. But in the context of what the 1990s and 80s looked like, I can understand why it would feel like an attack for another member of the community and a very young member of the community who didn't go through it with them. I can see why they would feel attacked by that. Absolutely. But I don't agree with it. I think it's a really, really loving, loving film. I do.
You know, it reminds me a lot of this history that I read back in high school. I went through a phase where I was really interested in Harvey Milk. I wrote a big paper about him, and I read the book about his life, The Mayor of Castro Street. And one of the things that I always took away from that history was how much conflict there was between the lesbian or woman-loving woman organizations in San Francisco and the gay men's organizations in San Francisco. And I recall from reading that, and I may be wrong, so correct me on this if I'm misremembering this history, but part of their conflict was that because of the history of Boston marriages and things like that, queer women had a kind of reputation for staying under the radar, in a sense, being able to pass, in a sense, although I would criticize that because I think it's probably more that women are just sort of oppressed in different ways. But these gay men's organizations were really pushing to be like very visible, very out, particularly because they were subject to a lot of violence in their bars, since they had more bars, I guess, because of, that inequality. It's just a really interesting history of conflict and also coalition building, too. I mean, it's not all conflict.
So I'm not as familiar with San Francisco specific history, but it's my understanding that sort of what you touched on here from the reading I've done, and I'm, not a queer scholar, except, for fun. It's my understanding that there was, over the course of the gay rights movement, sort of two general pools of we need to fit in and fuck fitting in. And it wasn't along gender lines. There was a lot of transphobia. There was a lot of racism. But it was very much, are we going to be respectable homophiles, the homophile organizations, or are we going to make waves? So that's, and especially in terms of the 90s and the AIDS crisis, lesbians were often caretakers for gay men. So it's hard. Right. I think it's a very tangled history. And I think I would want to read more before I gave any sort of definitive, this is what I think about, San Francisco during this period, because I'm not as familiar with it. I'm just more familiar with East Coast history. But it's, it's worth discussing how our history changes and what that looks like and the way our relationship exists now.
Yeah. And thinking about the history and the immediate context of this film, like you were saying, coming on the tail end of the AIDS crisis, And also coming very soon after the murder of Matthew Shepard.
Yeah.
And really this national interest in anti-queer violence and hate crimes. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really interesting to think about this movie coming in the wake of that, because maybe there is a sense that critics wanted it to be more serious, to take the violence against queer youth more seriously. But in a way, it does sort of take you back to those questions about, like, but isn't there also space for the John Waters of the world who are taking queerness as a space in which they can experiment and say fuck you to society in a way that is fun and lighthearted and reinstates joy.
And so much of this film is satirizing the idea that conversion therapy could ever work. You know, the titular character, Megan, she's a cheerleader. She's incredibly femme. She doesn't need lessons on how to, like, cook and clean. She's already doing all that. And it's, conversion therapy is so very serious. It's something that people who go through conversion therapy are so significantly more likely to have suicide ideation or commit suicide than people who don't. It's demonstrated. A lot of protesting against conversion therapy come from the National Center for Suicide Prevention. And it's still so, you know, it's 2021 and only 20 U.S. states have outright bans on therapy for minors. And I think only D.C. is the jurisdiction. Let me rephrase that. D.C. is the only place in the United States that bans it for adults. Like, this is a very present threat. And how do you measure that? And, you know, no matter how dark something is, there's nothing so dark that we can't satirize it. Mm. And that's, I think, what this film does. Because this is a fluffy romantic comedy about something that is a nightmare. And it's beautiful and it's cheerful and... how do you square that, you know? But I think we need art to do that. We need art to try and square that.
And I think that kind of tense contrast is what makes it work, right? I mean, mm-hmm. when we see that she's being carted off to this, you know, True Directions place, mm-hmm. our expectation, I would think, is that, like, oh God, what are they going to do? Is it going to be, like, torture? You know, is it going to be, like, incredibly psychologically abusive as these places are in real life? And instead, mm-hmm. what we're presented with is... the gayest possible thing. Like, they make the conversion therapy so queer. Like, the entire aesthetic of it is incredibly campy, incredibly colorful. It makes the gender binary queer, which is so genius. I can't even wrap my mind around it.
And if you think my femme ass doesn't want that house, are you kidding?
I mean,
zero notes. Move in right now.
The lesbian's little, like, garage apartment where it's four pink beds and everything's pink. God. Are you kidding? Are you actually kidding?
That I want. That's mine. That's what I want. Yes. I'm wearing a Taylor Swift sweatshirt right now. Let's go. Also, yeah, I unironically want RuPaul's Straight is Great shirt. I really, if anyone listening knows where I can get that, please forward it to the pod.
Yes, seriously, actually. Yeah, and, like, choices like that, like having RuPaul be the straight guy is just so, it's just a bit of sort of genius mockery. It is, and I think that is what makes that kind of violent contrast work.
And of course, this is also pre-RuPaul's Drag Race RuPaul. He was a much more subversive figure before he, you know, it became a millionaire and became a capitalist, because that's how that works. But, like, drag is incredibly subversive, and it's been slightly sanitized, and we don't need to get into the is RuPaul good representation debate. Things can be more than one thing. But he was so much more subversive than at this time, the time period of this film.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, RuPaul had, like, some singles out. RuPaul had been in some Mac ads, but, like, RuPaul was not America's sweetheart by any
That Mac campaign is so good.
But, you know, what you were saying about drag and whether or not that's good representation kind of makes me think about the character of Jan. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about how you think that they handle Jan's gender in the film, because if, for those who haven't seen it, mm-hmm. in the film, Jan is presented to us as one of the lesbians, and she is very sort of butch looking. She has, like, a very short mohawk haircut. She wears like cutoff t-shirts. Mm-hmm. She's a softball catcher. But by the end of the film, Jan says like, listen, I am Butch. Like I love like playing sports, all of these things. Like that's not me, but I also am attracted to men. Like I'm not a lesbian. I'm straight. And the True Directions, instead of celebrating her, chastises her and says, there's no way. You can't be those things.
I do want to make a quick point of clarification about what I said. Drag is awesome and subversive and necessary and a wonderful part of history. It's just, I think the debate is just whether or not RuPaul's Drag Race is good drag representation and what it's done to the community. I'm rambling a little bit. Sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah.
But so what do you think about Jan in that way and how so, she's represented?
It's interesting because when I first saw the movie when I was much younger and I was less aware of trans issues, and also I was thinking about this, rewatching this yesterday, and it had been, you know, at least 3 months since I had watched it. I first read that line as genuine, as a like sort of a subversion of the title, because you see someone like Megan, who's meant to be that stereotypical all-American girl. She's a cheerleader. She has the jock boyfriend. She's got her long blonde hair, and she's a lesbian. So the reverse of that would be Jan, who's this very stereotypically butch character who says that she can't be straight. Of course she can't be straight. There are straight women who dress masculine. But could she possibly be gender nonconforming? Could she be a trans man? Could she be non-binary? Of course she can be. And I think that's one of the great things about that character in this movie is that it's representation of the ambiguity of gender identity and the ambiguity of sexuality. And maybe this 17-year-old girl who's currently going through an incredibly traumatic experience, maybe she's gay, maybe she's straight, maybe she's trans, maybe she's some combination, but how can she even know for sure who she is while she's going through this experience? She's under so much pressure.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think that that ambiguity is really powerful and kind of makes the movie, that at least that part of the movie, feel very now in a way, right?
It's got that sort of ambiguous time period thing going for it. So while it does invoke like Edward Scissorhands, John Waters, it could be contemporary in small town America, or it could be the 50s.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely messes with time a lot. And the way that it portrays the, I guess what I would call the straight world outside of True Directions is quite funny. The parents all wear like shades of beige and brown. Mm-hmm. The school kids are all wearing, all the girls are wearing brown.
Yeah.
So strange. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the world of True Directions. And once again, it offers this very colorful, very campy environment. And I think that that's also sort of a part of the film's like fantasy. And it's showing you a very specific lens, right? This movie is not supposed to be a reflection of life. It's sort of like, what does life look like to Megan? What does life look like through Megan's eyes?
Oh, we need to get into female gaze then, don't we?
You are so smart, Melissa. That is exactly where I was going next. Hey, Melissa, what's going on with the female gaze in this movie?
There is so much going on with female gaze in this movie. Starting from the very first shots of what ostensibly would be male gaze. They are teenage girls. Even as a queer woman, I feel a little gross watching it because it's pure objectification. But, you know, the camera pans back and you realize these are teenage girls being objectified by a teenage girl, which is an immediate flip on its head of what you expect from this sort of gaze. So it's establishing that this film was about sexuality, of course. But this film, and I think it's really important, this is the first film I ever saw where there was a sex scene not shot from the male gaze.
Mm.
It is absolutely female gaze, a queer gaze. And it's funny because the sex scene is so like in an ambiguous, like lesbian space. Like, where are they? The lighting doesn't make sense. This beautiful song from like 1995 Seattle queer culture, punk culture is playing. Like, where is it? But I, you know, when I think I was 16 when I first snuck watching this movie, and it was just, it's really groundbreaking to me. And I don't know the history of male gaze, female gaze in cinema. I'm sure this wasn't the first film to do that, but a film that's marketed towards a younger queer audience, that's important. Audience. A younger queer audience.
That actually was kind of a funny pun, though. Audience. Artians.
Artians, yeah.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, there's two things that I want to say about what you've just said. The first is that it strikes me, too, that given that this movie came out in 1999, which was more or less the height of the American teen comedy, teen rom-com, that there's a kind of an inversion there, too, of audiences' expectations. There's so many teen rom-coms that objectify teen cheerleaders, right? Not just Bring It On, and I am calling out Bring It On.
We love Bring It On, but oh my God. Oh my God.
Oh my God. Oh my God. But like every other teen movie has a scene of, you know, teenage boys seeing young women's breasts and hips and butts and all of that stuff, right? So in a way, it's also in kind of conversation with that particular cultural moment of flipping it on its head, which is really clever. And then I guess my other thought after that is, I mean, for you, Melissa, what does it mean for the camera to have like a queer female gaze? Like, what are the qualities of that? And why does that scene in But I'm a Cheerleader meet that metric?
That's an interesting question. And it's funny because I have thought that for so long, even before I really had the language to articulate what different gazes are, before I, you know, went through the liberal agenda at college. But, you know, it's a sex scene that's not objectifying the women in it. You know, there's no nudity. It's very soft. It's very gentle. It's not like pornography shoved into a mainstream film. It's a gaze that cares about how much these two characters care about each other. And it's not, and there's a sort of recurring issue that comes up among queer women that I've discussed with other queer women that I've seen discussed about the uncomfortableness of sort of objectifying other women, because we, all women, straight, gay, regardless, go through that awful to go through. It's continuous of being objectified without your own consent. That old trope of lesbians are useless, we never know when we're hitting on each other, that happens because your agency is taken away so many times as a woman by some men when you're growing up. I mean, I think I first got catcalled when I was maybe 12. And it's so like entering queer spaces, especially when you're new to being out, you're so hyper aware of, I can't let the women around me feel that way, even if I don't intend it. It's this very real feeling. And of course, I'm not speaking for all queer women, but it's something I've spoken about and I've been spoken with about. So to have this sort of love scene that's very much a love scene, it's, you know, it's not pornography, it's special, especially in the context of so many other movies ostensibly for queer women. The example that comes to mind is Blue is the Warmest Color, which I actually refuse to watch, and I know a lot of us do. This male director had the two leads on their first day do an incredibly graphic sex scene that was essentially pornography. And it's, you know, it's that difference. It's care about your actors. Who is the scene for? What is the scene portraying? What does the scene add to the story?
Yeah, that all reminds me very much of, you know, our favorite lesbian warrior poet, Audre Lorde, and her essay, Uses of the Erotic, where she talks about how, I like to think that you can apply her sense of the erotic to all kinds of sexuality, but she's really specifically talking about women, loving women. And she also makes that kind of opposition to pornography, right? That's her argument. She says that the opposite of pornography is the kind of eros, the kind of erotics that take place between women, because it is coming from this deep emotional well rather than a sort of impulse to own the flesh, right?
Yeah.
And I think that part of it is so on display here. And I think that you're right? Like, we are so invested in Graham and Megan's connection more so than the culmination of their sexuality. I don't know. There's like, I don't know how I'm exactly formulating this off, but I think there's also a sense that like, maybe because I have been raised in a sort of, you know, heteronormative culture, my sense of virginity is very much penetrative penis and vagina sex, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's also this sense that like the kind of sex that Graham and Megan are having is, it can't be this objectifying culmination because it's not that in my mind, which I'm just really kind of realizing as I talk to you about it. Huh.
It's an interesting thing because like, of course women objectify other women. Of course, pornography is a valid we could just go down a rabbit hole, but pornography is not inherently invalid or inherently violent. It's always, especially in terms of queer films, who is this being made for? Who is this love scene for? What is this story servicing? Like I forget the conversation I was having exactly, but about lesbian representation and, oh, it's, I think his name's Mike Flanagan, the director who made Bly Manor and Hill House.
Yes.
He, in all three of the Netflix shows that I've seen from him, he's had prominent lesbian characters. And my friend who I was speaking to, who's not familiar with his work, had an immediate, why is this straight man always putting in lesbian characters? What is his angle? And it's interesting because you have that gut reaction of objectification of othering that can happen. But
yeah.
In his worlds, Bly Manor's a love story, first of all. But second of all, the fact that they're lesbians isn't the point. They're just people existing and they happen to be lesbians.
Right.
And this love story between Graham and Megan, of course, is inherently linked into their lesbianism. But take these two characters, put them in a different movie, it would still be a love story. And it wouldn't have to be about their lesbianism.
Right. Like, they don't fall in love because they are at this weird conversion camp. That's not why. They're not the only queer characters, right? That's another sort of thing, right? Like, there's not a kind of pairing off of the only queer characters in the story. That's not possible here.
Yeah. And no one dies.
And nobody dies. How about that?
Isn't that beautiful?
It is.
A rare and beautiful thing.
let's talk about Megan and Graham's relationship for a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, first, like, I just want to ask, like, what do you think about it? Like, what does it make you feel?
It's so cute. I was trying to remember how I first reacted to this movie, because I absolutely recorded it and then watched it while my parents were at home when I was still, I went to Catholic school and deep denial of not being straight to the point where it hadn't even occurred to me yet, while I also was sneaking, watching films like, But I'm a Cheerleader. And it's just, this was my personal first encounter with like a sweet love story between two girls. And like, oh my God. And Graham's so dreamy. Graham is so dreamy, Janelle.
I know, like, as a person who's attracted to masculinity, whoever that shows up on, I was like, wow. Oof.
Clea DuVall, she just understands the assignment every time.
She does. She does. She does. She sure does.
I have a trivia tidbit from this Jamie Babbitt interview I was listening to.
Please.
They met because Clea DuVall was working at the coffee shop that Jamie kept going to, and she kept hitting on her and giving her free stuff. And I was like, yes, thank you for that knowledge.
That sounds about right.
It's just a really, really cute love story where they're challenging each other and they're different. And, you know, they're still teenagers, so they're not on the same page and it's not perfect. But I don't know. I'm just rambling now. I just think it's really, really cute.
Yeah, I agree.
It's special.
Yeah. It's very special, the connection that they make. And you know, last week on the show, we talked about 10 Things I Hate About You. And in a way, I really appreciate that Clea DuVall's character Graham in this movie gets to sort of be the bad kid with the heart of gold, because that is my favorite teen rom-com archetype.
I had no idea.
I know, you're completely shocked. What? and I love that that she is paired off, instead of with 10 Things I Hate About You, you know, where the bad boy with heart of gold is paired off as sort of the reformed bad girl, or just the bad girl. In this case, we get the sweet cheerleader, like that contrast. And I wonder, like, what you think about, especially because Jamie Babbitt's thinking about this movie in many ways is about seeing herself represented as a femme lesbian. I mean, what do you think about the fact that what we have here is a, like, very femme girl with a more butch girl? Is that a representation that pleases you? Does it feel, like, too easy? I mean, what do you think? I'm just curious.
Oh, I don't think it's too easy at all. I think it's a realistic representation. I think this is getting into queer culture.
No, Melissa, I didn't bring you on here to talk about queer culture.
Oh,
come on.
God. My brain is scrambled, Janelle Walker. You know, the whole old idea of like a butch lesbian and a femme lesbian, that's real. That's a real coupling that happens often. And it's interesting because it's just playing with gender roles. We're just talking about gender super casually. an easy topic for all.
Indeed.
Indeed. Gender. So easy. Well, says two cis women.
Yeah.
I think it's a good thing. And I think we are also looking at it in the context of maybe, I think in our bubble in particular, we know we have many friends who are gender nonconforming or trans or butch. You know, that's, but a movie like this, Graham, who honestly is fairly soft butch, is a really subversive character to be the romantic lead. But she's so desirable. And Megan is so desirable in a different way. And it's so many Hollywood films either lean into the stereotypical, very butch masculine, barely a woman, versus the high femme, stiletto feminism kind of girl. Having these like two characters that read as normal people who aren't at extremes of the gender binary, but are sort of comfortable in their roles a bit. I think that's a good thing. I think it's nice representation. This is so personal. This movie for me is so personal, and I know it's personal for a lot of other women. And of course, I'm like trying to sound intelligent on a podcast about it, but I feel like this conversation is tapping into like something very important to me about, because I'm quite femme. I'm incredibly femme. I'm wearing Taylor Swift and I'm a pink bitch. And being, especially since I previously dated men and my sexuality falls somewhere in the spectrum of, whenever I'm dating women, I feel better. I feel more visible. And part of the issue I had when I was dating men was that I felt like a part of me was being erased. And this femme representation is so important because so many women don't present as that sort of stereotypical old Hollywood view of what a lesbian looks like.
I think that the film's title, even, it's sort of iconic, funny, campy title, which is in itself, it almost sounds like a teen gone awry shocker from the 1950s, like, young girl turns out to be an invert. What is she going to do?
I identify as an invert now, by the way.
Yeah, that's
great. That's what I've settled on.
I'm so glad you're coming out to me here on the podcast.
extremely gay. Some conditions apply.
But I think that the title itself kind of alludes to that problem, right? That like what Megan is struggling with, and I know you have a lot of thoughts on this topic, is essentially compulsory heterosexuality, right? She thinks that because she's a cheerleader, that means she's not a lesbian. But I'm here to tell you listeners, that math does not make sense.
Does not. God, compulsory heterosexuality. And I've spoken to you about this a lot, Janelle, and it's a big conversation. It's a conversation that I've seen sort of rise up online over the course of the pandemic, because so many of us, as we should be, were locked up. I was in my small Brooklyn apartment with my cat. And I identified as bisexual for so long. And it's compulsory heterosexuality is the idea that society defaults to heterosexuality, that no matter what you're feeling, anything can be explained away by your latent attraction to the opposite gender. You know, there's a lot of wrong assumptions there. Gender's a spectrum. The default is not the norm. But for women, especially, when you grow up hearing things like, you know, the boys that are the meanest to you are the ones that like you and sex is always bad, that has an impact and it really lingers. So, and I think that's really exemplified by this film, because Megan in the beginning, she is aware she doesn't like kissing her boyfriend and that she likes to look at women, and it never even occurs to her that she's gay. And she's aware that gay women exist. They establish that. Mm-hmm. And that's compet. I don't even know where I started with this.
No, that's absolutely the thing I want to talk about. I think that the film does a marvelous job of speaking truth to compet without using those words. And also does it in like a really funny way. You know, we have those hilarious scenes of Megan making out with her boyfriend with this just sort of like slack-jawed mouth, and he's just licking around on the inside of her teeth, which is absolutely foul, but it is so funny.
I love her so much.
She's fantastic in this film. And then they also have all these other little things, right? Like when RuPaul comes to collect her and take her away to True Directions, the evidence levied against her as being a lesbian is not that she has sex with women. It's not that she dates women. It's that she's a vegetarian. It's that she has a vaginal looking flower design on her pillow. It's that she has pictures of girls up in her locker. And of course, we come to find out that she absolutely is a lesbian. Mm-hmm. But of course, once again, it's sort of poking fun at the like, yeah, but 1 + 1 does not equal 3 there all the time.
Yeah. Well, the girl in the bikini in the locker was pretty damning.
That's pretty clear. Well, you know, she's a lesbian. She is.
Yeah. but tofu does not a homosexual make. It's just, you know, a Venn diagram.
Yes. Yes. When we get down to it, sexuality is not a spectrum. It's more like a Venn diagram.
Everything is made up and the points don't matter. Can we talk about Larry and Lloyd?
Let's talk about Larry and Lloyd. The XX gaze.
The XX gaze.
Tell me what you think about Larry and Lloyd, the XX gaze.
I think they're such an interesting little part of the film because obviously they're played for comedy, in spite of the fact that they are quite important. They are literally rescuing children from conversion therapy. But I think what's interesting about them is that scene at the dinner table with Dolph and Megan, and Larry and Lloyd get into an argument. And Larry Bear, is a large, intimidating-looking man who's quite stereotypically masculine, and they have this very genuine conversation where they communicate how they're feeling and accept each other. And it's a little played for laughs, but what a wonderful example of a happy, stable adult couple.
Oh, yeah, and they are the only happy, stable adult couple that we encounter in the film.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Like how I just, that's my entire point. It's, they snuck in good relationship representation in the background while you weren't looking.
Yeah, no, and that's why those scenes at their house are some of my favorites, especially because, and I've never talked about this on the podcast, but I guess I should. So I live in Houston in the historical gay neighborhood, Montrose. And since I've moved here, I've encountered a lot of people who have lived here for decades or, you know, even just moved here recently that are very committed to the kind of community building that Larry and Lloyd are, right? Where it's about taking care of the youth, not necessarily as your job, not necessarily to the extreme that you are rescuing kids from conversion therapy. But there is this very clear sense from elder queers in the community, it seems like, to take care of the youth, right? To lend them the support and the knowledge that they have from the experiences that they've had. And I've been constantly like amazed and blown away by that very real culture in the community. Like I said, like Larry and Lloyd are not an anomaly that I have seen, at least in the community in which I live.
No, they're real and they're wonderful. And it's important representation because we lost a generation during the 90s. Yeah. So a lot of those people who would have been those community elders, we lost. So having them in a movie is really, really wonderful.
Yeah.
And just going to a sad place.
Why do we keep going to the sad place? No sadness. This movie is about delight. Actually, can we talk about something that is like, that is gay, but is not necessarily about gay issues? Are you ready for it?
I was hoping we would.
Can we talk about the soundtrack?
Yes, we can. Oh my god, the soundtrack is so good. So good. And you just know, because Jamie Babbitt, she loved all of the indie riot girl Seattle. Like, so much of the music came off of mixtapes that were passed around Seattle in the 90s. How cool is that?
Yeah, it's absolutely magnificent. I mean, it really ties up how aesthetically cohesive this movie is, which is why it has persisted as such a cult classic, besides obviously the representation. I mean, it just creates a very clear, very specific vision that is like campy, but also punk rock, but also like so of its moment, right? Like there's so much of what you're later going to see in Ghost World in this movie. You know, there's so much of a reflection of sort of the like 90s Gen X movies in this film. But it's all set up in this very perfectly distinct camp confection. And the soundtrack is a major part of that.
I mean, the song Glass Vase, Jello Case, that is the love theme. It plays over the love scene and it plays at the end. That beautiful strings. What a perfect song. Mm. And it's, you know, it's from, I love the story of the song. It's from a band, they were called Tattletale, and it was these two teenage girls who formed the band in 1992 in Seattle. They were 15 and 17, and they wrote this music, and they were together for a few years before they split up. And they still, both of them, make music separately. Bonfire, Madigan, Jen Wood, Give Them Your Money. And it's interesting to hear them talk about it, because they sort of were, this song is sort of their being, the song is them being plucked out of obscurity in a lot of ways, because, you know, you go on Twitter, you put in glass face, jello case, which is a fairly unique phrase, and you see people talking about this movie and how much they want to know where the song is that's not on Spotify, because Spotify pays their artists like shit. So to get it, you have to go to Bonfire Madigan and buy it, and how this movie contributes to them still getting residuals on this song they wrote when they were teenagers in, I don't know, 94. That's so cool. Yeah.
So what are your final thoughts on But I'm a Cheerleader? What do you want to impart to the listeners?
Oh, what I want to impart. So we talked about a lot of hard, sad things, like, around the greater context of this movie. Which is sort of interesting, because a note I wrote down while watching this was that I wanted to think more about queer joy than the negative, sort of the negativity that can surround queerness. This movie, one of the reasons why it's so celebrated and it's so loved is because it is, at the end of the day, a celebration of queer identities and playing with gender roles and found family and found love. And we need more movies. Like, this is why I haven't watched The Happiest Season yet. Because we don't need more narratives about how tragic coming out can be. We need more queer joy. And we need more joy for young women and gender nonconforming people and trans kids. And, you know, conversion therapy is still a threat. And a lot of things are still a threat. But that doesn't mean we can't make art that is joyful and happy and camp and weird and special and challenging the mainstream in a way that is devastating.
This is the time of the show every week where we take a break to thank our patrons on Patreon. And most especially our romantic leads, one of whom is on the show with us today, Melissa. Special thanks to you. I love you.
I bribe you to get on. I love you.
But we also have to shout out to our other romantic leads, Melissa's fellows. They are Bob, Esther, Ian, and Trey. You know, I'm your cheerleader. I'm in your corner. That's me.
That was great, Joe.
Thank you. I try every time. Most of them are bad, but sometimes I get a decent one. If Eliza were here, she would tell you to follow us on Instagram at @romcomkilljoys, follow us on Facebook, and check out our merch store at threadless.romcomkilljoys.com.
There are great tote bags. I have one.
And if you'd like to support the show, like our romantic leads, you can become a patron on Patreon for as low as $1 a month. That's $12 a year. And join Melissa and crew as part of our Romcom Killjoys family. So, Melissa, you know the show. At the end of every show, we choose either supplements if we like the movie or antidotes if we have some concerns for the movie. So what are your supplements or antidotes for But I'm a Cheerleader?
So I had, I think I have three supplements. I will make them brief.
Beautiful.
The first is... They don't have to be brief. Thank you. I'm a romantic lead, so I feel like I should...
You're in charge.
I should have this time. That's what the people want.
That is.
My first rec is Alexandria Belfleur's really quite delightful romantic novel written in the stars. It is a little lesbian romance novel about these two girls, one of whom is an astronomer. Astronomer? No. One of whom is an astrologer and the other is, I don't know, some sort of accountant. But it's, you know, an anti-meet-cute, enemies to lovers. It's just really adorable and happy. And everyone is out and everyone loves them and there's no issues beyond, will these two crazy kids get together? Yes, yes, they will. It's a romance novel. It's adorable. My second supplement is a movie Eliza absolutely hates, Debs. because Eliza and I recently watched it together. She did not enjoy it because of this podcast. She is incapable of uncritically watching films, whereas I love films that give me no thoughts, head empty vibes. And Debs, you don't want to think too hard about it. You don't. But it is a delightful little parody of James Bond movies done through the lens of a teenage girl falling in love with a really hot supervillain played by Jordana Brewster. It's great.
Love that.
It's terrible. It's a bad movie. You'll love it. I know what it is. And my third rec is actually to encourage everyone to look up the local laws in their state around conversion therapy. I think I said at some point in the pod, only 20 states outright ban it for kids. It's very dangerous. It's a present threat. Nearly a million people in the U.S. that we know of have gone through it. If you're not sure where to start, the National Center for Lesbian Rights has the Born Perfect campaign. You can also look at Trevor Project, Human Rights Campaign. Someone in your state is doing something, and you can help.
We'll include some resources also with the show notes for the episode. Yeah, so my elements are a lot along the same lines. I mean, first, I'll do my Professor Walker thing and recommend one of my absolute favorite academic books of all time. Ooh. If you're into that sort of thing, it's kind of the intellectual version of a banger.
intellectual banger.
Yes. It is from an American studies scholar named Lisa Dugan, who's at NYU, I believe. Her first book is called Sapphic Slashers, Sex, Violence, and American Modernity. And it is about the true story of a lesbian couple, Alice Mitchell and Frida Ward. Alice killed Frida in the middle of the street in Memphis, Tennessee in 1892. And Lisa Dugan does an incredible job of showing how the case was covered in such a way that it really codified what we know as today in America as the modern lesbian, and the stereotypes or the kind of clear categories of femme and butch in some ways were starting to be defined in the public imagination by this case. It's a fabulous book, incredibly well-researched, has many fascinating things to say, not only about gender and sexuality in America, but also the history of race and racial terrorism. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to sit down with, like, you know, a 325-page book about lesbians killing each other, do it.
Hell yeah.
Get it from your local library. Great. That is not about queer joy, though, so I want to also recommend something that's about queer joy and also, like, queer immaculate sadness, cue the Sufjan Stevens. I also want to recommend the film Call Me By Your Name, which I only saw this weekend because I am a delinquent. It came out in 2017. And the reason why I'm recommending it is not just because it's a beautiful film about queer love, in this case between two men, but it's also in some ways a movie about how, like you said, Melissa, coming out doesn't have to be this, you know, clear scenario of the mom, dad, I'm gay variety, mm-hmm. right? It can be a gradual becoming. It can be a realization. It can be soft and intimate, and the people around you can just know. And I say that because I met a couple this weekend, and they recommended the film to me, and their description of it was that it makes it seem like coming out is not the worst thing that's ever going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it kind of proposes that your first love breaking your heart is the worst thing that's going to happen to you. Spoilers, but you know,
well,
we can all relate to accurate. That.
And sometimes your best friend of many years, Eliza Bertrand, knows you're gay a decade before you do.
Da 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 da. Well, Melissa, I just want to wish you a belated happy coming out day, I guess.
Oh, thanks.
Is that a thing?
I made a dumb post on Facebook and Twitter, I think. So, you know, I celebrated that I identify as a problem, I think I said.
Hey.
Hey, that's dumb. Got that.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time. Start some kissing and making